This week in Retronauts, all our hosts are male, so I think you'll find we have men here. Hello, welcome to Retronauts. I'm Stuart Gipp, your indomitable host, and we are talking about the toast of Europe. Yes, that's right. We're talking about Asterix. Is that how it's pronounced? Asterix?
Asterix, yeah.
Asterix, okay. And whether or not you're familiar with Asterix, I think you'll find we've got an excellent crowd here to talk about it, so let's introduce all of them. Let's start with someone who has never, ever been on Retronauts before, but has in fact listened to Retronauts, and that's, hello, who are you? Explain.
Who, me?
Yes.
Well, it's about damn time on here. I'm Audie Surly. You might know me from Digital Foundry, where I co-produced DF Retro with my dear friend John Linemanix, and also producer at Limited Run Games. Not Limited Run Pants.
I heard you mention John Linemanix there, so hello, John, how are you today?
Oh, as the token American on this podcast, I am doing quite well, and I'm eager to talk about the superior European mascot, Asterix, not Hugo.
Oh, God. Hugo. There's an episode in waiting. And who else is with it? Who else is with us today?
So, hello, I'm Thomas Nickel, as you might have already guessed from the description of the podcast, and I want to mention a bit of background. So, to get this straight, Gallia est omnis divisa in partes tres, quarum unam in colon Belgae, alium Aquitani, tertiam qui ipsorum lingua Celtae nostra Galli appellantur.
Whoa, you can't say that. That's, come on.
Whoa.
Not appropriate.
I think he just swore in like 50 languages.
This is a G-rated podcast.
Yeah, yeah. You can't say things like that, honestly. And as I said, I'm Stuart Gipp, and I'm not allowed to have any games because I fell into the cauldron of games when I was a little. That doesn't really work. Just forget that
so
whole thing.
So you're just like eternally, you know, playing.
Well, I thought I would end up like Obelix, but unfortunately, I'm just basically the shape of Obelix, but very weak. Mm. So it's really quite upsetting.
I tried to get some.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've sort of stepped on your joke there. Do you also find it difficult to find blue and white striped pants?
You know, I am more of the stature of Asterix himself, a little bit shorter with a big mustache. So I find clothes very easily at the boys section at H&M.
That's good. I go to Marks and Spencer and I say, excuse me, do you have any blue and white light striped? And they go, I just sold the last pair to that guy. And I look over and it's Bashful Bert from Yoshi's Island on his way out the door.
You always have to check at Marcus at Spencius. He will find more there.
Yeah. I think that's going to be a recurring gag throughout this podcast.
Hello.
Or should I say
no.
Podcastios or whatever. See, that's the thing with Asterix is like all the characters have like joke names in the UK version at least. You've got like get a fix of the potion, right?
It's in every version out there. Everyone has a joke name localized
through every language.
But you've got like vital statistics. I get that, right?
Yeah,
I get a get a fix, but I don't get Julius Caesar. What's the joke? I don't.
Yeah,
it's very strange. It's like a historical character.
It might be the salad, maybe. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, more importantly, at this point, because we've already been hilariously bantering for a few minutes now, what we need to establish initially is what the goddamn hell is Asterix? Like, what is this thing?
Well, so for us in Europe, it's pretty familiar, I think, at least of our generation.
Yes.
It was a comic book or comic novel that started, I think, around the 50s, right? It was 59, I think. So at the tail end of the 50s, it started coming out. Very influential due to the post-war situation in Europe. You know, many countries have been ravaged, and politicians as such had become sort of scary. And politics in itself was uncertain. They were confusing because all these countries were now rebuilding. And as such, I think the best way to deal with that is through humor and satire. So Asterix is kind of a world view viewed through some weird Belgian jokes, I guess.
Yeah.
But the tale is, of course, of a little village in Gaul that has not surrendered over to the Romans during the Roman Empire and can resist their forces via the magic potion, which is brewed by Panoramix in their village.
Yeah.
And through all those different albums, there's different adventures that they go on based on satire and kind of myths of different cultures in Europe and as well as Americas and Asia throughout time. So it's a comic book that kind of embraces all kinds of different influences and aspects of the world, satirizes a lot of them, lots of characters, but it has a very good heart in the middle of it, of this kind of unified people with the good, simple, pure hearts. And I think that's kind of what, in a rebuilding Europe at the time, made it so influential.
I think it's also pretty nice that you have this mixture. You have the jokes for the kids about Romans getting beaten up. You have the jokes for the grown-ups about the political stuff and the cliches of different nations. And also, I think what most of us are missing, of course, a lot of in-jokes about current French political scenes back in these days.
Yeah. You know, the French themselves are very eager to, you know, poke fun at other nations, but as well as themselves.
Yeah.
So you kind of get this very raw satire, this social satire that you wouldn't find, you know, in comic books from the U.S., especially for the 60s and 70s up. I mean, even somewhat today, American comics are very symbolic and very kind of, I shouldn't say nationalistic because that's a very wrong word, but they have like a symbol of kind of this American bravery a lot through it.
It's kind of quite jingoistic, and
yeah,
I suppose you could say. Yeah.
And whereas Asterix was a little bit more self-deprecating and a little bit more kind of ambivalent in where it stood. It really didn't have a nationality as such, other than the characters themselves being fairly pure.
Yeah.
It's also maybe one thing to note is the conflicts are usually not too high and too much escalated. And even the Romans, as the danger usually, are not that bad in many cases, especially Julius Caesar is never portrayed as this mustache-twirling villain, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, he's never maniacal. There, you could say that there's probably some differences in the cartoons, which I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about. Because the characterizations there kind of go towards more stereotypical. But in the actual comics, you're absolutely right in the sense that even the opposition to the Gauls is fairly, I shouldn't say neutral, but it's somewhat balanced out. They're never too menacing.
Well, I mean, one of my abiding memories of the books is they're kind of chill. Like Asterix and Obelix mostly are just kind of walking around, looking at stuff, and sort of reacting to it, talking to people. And it's when they do beat people up, it's always in this kind of burst of kind of comic energy rather than like just any, like, it's always the same. It's always like, you know, paff, out they come from their shoes, you know?
Yeah, I think it's similar.
When they run into those pirates and they beat the shit out of them.
Yeah, which is always amazing.
Yeah.
I think, for Americans to understand, Asterix and Obelix is sort of like, in Avatar sense, they're similar to C-3PO and R2-D2 in the sense that they're in the middle of a lot of these obstacles and conflicts. But often as involuntary spectators that just kind of have to resort to their bravery, in order to help out. So you can look at stuff like Star Wars and even like Kurosawa movies like that, and kind of see what the appeal is.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing is this is a series relatively unfamiliar, I think, to most Americans, or at least those of a similar age to myself that grew up in the U.S. We were inundated with a very different type of cartoons and and I guess graphic novels and such. And when you talk about the influences and what Asterix is about, it makes sense because the political situation, the post-war period, America didn't experience it the same way. So it doesn't resonate in that way either, nor do the types of jokes, the humor of Asterix really translate that well over. And in fact, America itself is probably has more in common with, you know, the Roman Empire as it is in Asterix. More imperialist, if you will.
Maybe. I mean, it's a good point. But
the Americans are just saying, why don't they just kill them?
When you talk about symbolics, though, you look post-war and you look at like Superman, and you have a lot of the same threads through, but the symbolism is different, and the kind of the intent of it is a little bit different.
It's presented quite differently, share, I think.
Yeah.
I don't want to jump ahead, but I want to mention it because you mentioned Superman. I want to mention that, like, really controversial Asterix book, Asterix in the Falling Sky.
Yes.
When, like, kind of Superman kind of turns up.
Yes.
Like, sort of alien turns up, and then this disgusting, like, manga insect thing turns up. And the comic seems to be about how the only good thing is Disney, and manga is disgusting, and American comics are stupid. Unless I've massively misunderstood it.
Yeah, no, I
don't
know. And
it's one of the more overtly angry ones that they've done. It's very different to any of the other books, and I just wanted to mention it because
it's also been a big break when this came out, because this was so badly received that I think there was an 8-year hiatus afterwards, and then a new team took over.
Yeah, I mean, so Asterix has gone through a lot of different... I mean, so it was run by Goscinny and Uderzo, who created it. They oversaw a lot, but it certainly had a lull period, which is around that time. And another important aspect to Asterix, which is also kind of like a European thing, is that it was fairly counterculture in how it approached things. And you can look at... if you look at something like... You mentioned Disney, and if you watch the cartoon, which is called The 12 Tasks of Asterix...
Oh, boy.
That pulled fun. A fantastic film.
Yeah.
And they poke fun at... They even go as far as showing Donald Duck on screen as kind of like a middle finger to Disney, because at the time, Disney, throughout the 70s and 80s, was kind of... Well, especially into the 80s when you get the Renaissance going.
Yeah.
Had a stranglehold on the animation industry and theaters. And Asterix was one of the few kind of big animation properties that competed with Disney at the time. And in my opinion, did it very well. I think some of the Asterix films are much better than what Disney was putting out, both from an animation aspect and story.
It's mostly films, right? There isn't, like, yet, and it hasn't been, like, an ongoing animation kind of series. They've just been making movies, is that right?
They did Edithix, which is the dog.
That
got, like, a children's cartoon, which is very much for children. That was recently. It's based on the new 3D movies.
I only know him as Dogmatix, but that's just... Dogmatix is... what a ridiculously great name. Sorry. I can't believe how good that is.
This is another confusing aspect, I think, for Americans, is that the characters have different names per region. And I usually just go by, like, European/French. I think there was an attempt of localizing the Asterix to the American market a couple times.
Yeah.
To change the names further.
Yeah.
And this is something that I discovered. John mentioned, you know, from his perspective, when he was growing up, Asterix was just a kind of like a curiosity, but nothing else. And this, when I started working in the Americas in the early 2000s, I kind of took Asterix with me. I've been a lifelong fan, and which can be pretty visible from my articles about it. And I was kind of stunned of how little knowledge Americans had of the property, even though it wasn't part of their pop culture. It was just always like, I heard about it in French class. That was the one thing I heard the most. It's like, I remember seeing this in French class, but I didn't know it was a thing. And it's like, for a property that has, you know, over 50 albums and how many movies now, I think?
Nine movies today.
10 or 9 movies today, all of which are high profile, high budget animations.
The video games. The Asterix and Obelix versus Caesar movie, I understand, was one of the most expensive French productions of all time. The 1999
of all time.
Movie. Yeah.
And I don't incredible. Know
how, the one with Gérard Depardieu as Obelix, yeah. I believe. Yeah. Yeah.
I really like that one, too. I think I'm not a big fan of the sequels to the live action, but the first one I like quite a lot.
Yeah.
The new 3D movies, if you haven't seen them,
the CG ones, yeah.
Domaine de Dieu, Magique Le Pogeon, and the last one is coming out soon. But those are fantastic.
Wasn't there a new live action one released just in 2023?
On Netflix, which I've heard is not very good. The Middle Kingdom.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Okay. I've heard it's fairly.
I'll skip that.
Yeah, I've heard it's fairly problematic.
I've not seen like Mansions of the Gods, but I've heard it's great, so I would like to watch it.
Yeah, that's a fantastic film, and that's the thing about Asterix. Like I mentioned, when I was in the U.S., the fact that like it was only relegated to this knowledge of like, well, the French like it, I think, and there's some video games based on it, and I was like, you know, there's over 20 video games, and they're actually, in fact, across the board, very good. And I guess that's a segue into the actual topic.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would like to keep talking about the history of it, but we really ought to talk about the video games, unfortunately.
Yeah, there's so much to say.
Yeah, I will mention real quick before we do that the localization or the translation by Anthea Bell and Derek Hockridge into English, sort of as called the UK translations, which I grew up with. They're really incredible. The way that they've worked so hard to preserve all the puns and the wordplay and such by replacing them with, you know, localized versions of the jokes. I remember there was a lot of sadness when Anthea Bell passed away in 2018. It was one of those kind of pour one out for a homie kind of moments, you know?
That was another aspect of Asterix, dude, that was so incredible, was like the localization effort per country. Because, like, I grew up in Norway. And our localization was also quite good, and I know that the German one was also really good.
If you can indulge me for a second, I can share one bit of knowledge about that, because there's actually two German localizations. There was a first one made by a completely different company and translator, and this was terrible, very, very bad. It was a very far-right reinterpretation of the whole story.
Jesus.
And when the creators found out about that, they got so angry, they immediately revoked the rights to everything. And then a new one was made in the spirit of the original. So this old one, they turned the Gauls into Germans, and they made it a parable to the American forces stationed in Germany back then. So terrible stuff.
Jesus, that's horrible.
I mean, I think you can't get something like Asterix more wrong if you tried.
Yeah, no. I mean, making Asterix explicitly kind of ideological in any way seems like a misfire. I mean, that's why I didn't love that, you know, Asterix in the Falling Sky, because it posits something very specific, like...
Yeah.
What's the... Udezo? I don't want to give the name. Udezo doesn't like American comics and doesn't like manga and wants you to know about it.
And of course, the thing is also, Udezo is the artist. Goscinny is a writer, and Goscinny is a brilliant writer, I think.
Yeah.
Well,
Goscinny wrote some comics that I had as a child. I had some Is No Good comics.
Mm-hmm.
And they are absolutely hilarious, like cleverly plotted, 8-page little pieces of joy.
One of the best satire writers of all time.
Yeah.
And when you talk about ideology, another thing about Asterix, we're never going to get to the games plan.
No, we're never. Sorry, listeners.
But one thing that was very special about it, especially today when it comes to representation and kind of open-mindedness, was that Asterix, as satirical as it is, because there are depictions that are a little bit problematic and such, but it's equal across the board. But the one thing that they did do was that they showed different types of people that generally in comic books or in entertainment did not get representation. And it was never mean-spirited, other than when it came to, for example, like you mentioned that Falling Sky and things like this. If the writers took it in a problematic way, in a direction, it could happen. But like in general, Goscinny and Uderzo were open-minded. And at the time, 50s, 60s, 70s, it was somewhat unheard of, even in Europe, to have this kind of colorful representation across the board. So there's many reasons why Asterix more so than just being in French class or be having some video games, is an incredibly important aspect of European culture and something that I wish worldwide was a little bit more recognized. I haven't even talked to you about when I worked in Japan, how they viewed it. And because it was even less known there, it was literally
only known via
the Konami game. And yeah. I talked to someone when I was at Beep, Maruyama-san, and we were talking about just my influences from Europe, and I mentioned that I was a huge fan of Asterix. And he was like, oh, yeah, Konami made some good characters and games back then. And I was like, it's not, I mean, there is a Konami game, but he's not
That's
made by Konami.
They thought it was, they thought it was an original. That's absolutely fascinating.
Same with Turtles. There was a lot of people when I worked in Japan several years ago, whenever I did like retro gaming meetups and stuff with people, there were always someone that thought that the Turtles were originally a Konami property.
Oh,
and then
wild.
Became a cartoon. And it, you know, it's because of how these things are introduced in Japan and how entertainment from afar is handled. So it's not like super shocking or anything. But when it comes to Asterix, it was just such a unknown property. And I would imagine that the localization efforts on such a thing into Japanese would be fairly hard to keep.
Yeah.
Authentic.
I mean, in the UK, it was first put out, I believe, well, maybe not first, but it was serialized in one of DC Thompson's comics as Big Fred and Little Ed, which is just inaccurate on every level. But that's what you get if you want UK comics. You're going to get people called Big Fred and Little Ed. It's very sad. But Asterix was also in video games, astonishingly enough.
A couple.
Yeah, like a handful,
please,
yeah.
Maybe allow me to make one more remark quickly, because it just occurred to me. So the way we are sitting together right now, acoustically, are we doing a reenactment of The Great Crossing in Britain, the Normans and the Goths? Could you argue for that? I
guess we could argue
that
in some way this is very apt.
If we could begin with the first Asterix game, which was Asterix was quite imaginatively named for the Atari 2600 and or VCS, released in 1983, and it's just another version of, well, it was originally Taz, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was originally Taz. I think it was originally released as Taz first, right?
Yeah.
It's a Steve Wojda game, I think.
Right.
And yeah, it's a strange little one. It's one of the few, I mean, as a conversion, it's nothing much either. It literally, I think the Taz game was like a whirlwind. And then for Asterix, they just changed things to cauldrons and Asterix's head, like silhouette.
Yeah, it's like literally moving an icon around screen.
That's astonishing.
Yeah, it's really a nothing game. I don't think Taz in itself is that great. But it is certainly interesting because I remember, so I think you mentioned at the beginning of the episode here that I did a big Hardcore Gaming 101 article about every Asterix game ever made back in the day. I think it still is available.
It's still there and it's still great. However, I must urge you not to read it until you're finished listening to the podcast.
Yes. This is a audiobook version of it. It was a Atari 2600 game kind of specifically for the European market with that conversion, and there wasn't too many of them. Because I remember the VCS not being much of a thing here. I was born, you know, mid-80s, so by the time I started playing games in, like, 87, 88, so by that time, I think the VCS was kind of out.
I mean, I think the difference was that computer games were more popular in Europe at that time, right?
I mean, Commodore 64, 1983, and really the VCS by that time was even, compared to the Commodore 64, it was just a kind of nothing deal. And it's a very much an American product. This episode just sounds like we're absolutely hating on American culture. That's fine.
I'm absolutely fine with that.
It's all right.
I like the Ninja Turtles and WWF. But, like, yeah, I remember it was kind of strange. And when I was in Germany recently, I did see a copy at a store called Küchenmischer. They had a copy of Asterix, which is one of the few times I've seen, like, a boxed VCS game for a PAL game there.
Yeah,
that's kind of cool.
Rather uncommon.
If it wasn't super expensive, it might be snap out.
That game, I think at the time I wrote the article, it would have been in 2011. At the time, the game wasn't worth much. But I checked it fairly recently because, I have a couple of games I'm missing in my Asterix collection, and the PAL version of this is actually one of them. And it's kind of skyrocketed in price.
You're not surprised in the slightest. The market's gone insane. So
yeah. It's these weird kind of gaps there. Like, you know, most of the Asterix games aren't that expensive. Until this episode comes out.
There's like a handful that get prices that I would consider too high for what they actually are, but
some of the core games definitely up there.
Weirdly enough, the 360 version of Asterix at the Olympic Games can go quite expensive, which is weird.
That's also some of them. We'll probably get to those sometime this year. So the Atari game is very much a product of Atari.
Yeah.
It feels like an Atari game, and I was never much of a fan.
Atari 2600 games for me, almost more than any other system. A bad VCS game is just like fucking garbage. Excuse my language.
Mm.
The distance between good and bad on that system is so ridiculously high.
It's astronomical.
When you get something like Frostbite, it's just amazing. You get something like Kaboom, amazing. But then you get something like, I guess, Asterix, and it's kind of stinking.
Or Taz.
But this
was
followed
up. Tile screen to Taz?
Oh. No. Or the box art even is pretty funny.
Yeah, the box art.
And this is of course Taz based on the original shorts rather than Tasmania, which came 10 years later. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think this game is necessarily like horrific or anything. It's very much a game of that time period.
It's
a no button game. Just manipulate the character around the screen.
Yeah.
In Taz, you're like dodging dynamite and collecting hamburgers and
burgers.
Yeah, that's what
right?
he does. That's what I do in my life too.
Basically changed all the icons to like a cauldron, apples, stuff like that, right?
It's the most basic interpretation of a game, right? It feels like something that would be in like a 1976 movie about video games.
Mm.
It's like, check out this new video game, and it's literally just lines and an icon moving up and down.
It is the minimum you can do for something to be a video game. Like, it is bordering on like Tiger Electronics handheld kind of game.
So this is parallel lines that occasionally have gaps you can nip through. Is that right? Am I imagining this, or
you just move up and down while dodging stuff?
Right.
It's literally just that.
Okay, that's even worse than I imagined. But it was followed up in the same year, wasn't it? Like, or I say followed up. There was another Asterix adjacent game in the same year.
Obelix.
Yeah, for the VCS. Yeah,
Obelix. And was this any better?
No, so this is...
I think it's certainly more interesting, is it?
It's more interesting, but it plays worse.
But it's more thematically relevant, is it?
Like, Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, so the main thing about this is that this seems to be of that era when Atari was trying to make games that perhaps played more like, that were more advanced, right? Like the original Asterix is just this very simple, like 70s arcade game kind of design, where this is more like trying to take something that is more conceptually complex and apply these characters to it. So you pretty much control Asterix running around in the playfield, and you have like Obelix at the top, right? And he's like dropping. What is he dropping? It's like squares of pixels.
Well, it's his menu.
Yeah, so the square is supposed to be a menhir. Like the stones that they carve.
Yeah. Okay.
Because that's his trademark. And I mean, in terms of branding, in terms of the identity of the game, it's certainly leagues above the original. Yeah. Whereas the other one feels like the most basic interpretation of a video game. This feels more like an actual concept, like you mentioned, but I just don't think it works too well.
It's not very fun.
Yep.
But I do appreciate that you kind of get the sprites. I guess they are sprites, yeah. Right?
I actually want to compliment that because the Atari VCS has access to very few pixels, right? And yeah. Yet they somehow managed to make characters that are identifiable as what they're supposed to be.
That is impressive. Yeah.
It also shows how strong the design of Asterix and Obelix actually is, because just those few little pixels with the right color, you know, is enough to let you sort of figure out what you're looking at. Like, they even have, like, Obelix's pants sort of drawn correctly, yep, with the blue and white colors. You know, it's...
Oh, that's nice.
I think it's actually, like, super impressive given the platform it's on.
Yeah, I mean, it's late, right? It's 83, right before the collapse.
Weirdly enough, It came out in 83 in the US, but 84 in Europe, which feels like It's backwards.
Yeah. I mean, the collapse to some extent, I mean, in the UK, that more or less didn't happen. We kept on microcomputers.
Oh, we can go. Yeah. It's one of my biggest pet peeves, about game history on YouTube and such.
Believe me, I'm right there with you about that. Like, there were no games made between, like, 1983 and 1985. Yes, there were. There were hundreds of games, thousands.
Yeah.
And some of them are great.
It's a really market-specific crash. It's very specific to the U.S. market, which in itself kind of recovered and too fast for me to really feel like it's much of a story, but it sounds very romantic.
It's just Atari basically messing up the business.
Yeah. To this day, and I'm not saying this to dig at Americans again, but to this day, game history is essentially dictated by the American perspective. That's fine. It's the biggest, audience. It's the biggest perspective. But when I'd see, as you say on YouTube, I see history videos about video games that are just wrong. And they get picked up and taken as gospel, and it's like, what's your source, Stu? Well, I was there watching it happen. I get that quite a lot with Sonic, but that's a whole other issue.
It's same for me, right? Because I'm someone that grew up in Europe, but my career has been in America. I worked for Destructoid and, Limited Run Games now, been on Digital Foundry. And, like, one thing I've always tried to do is to inject a lot of European game history. John can tell you from experience that things will get weird when we make a video together, because there's so much else I want to talk about than just that surface level American perspective stuff. And the crash is definitely one of those things where I always tune out when it comes up in a documentary. It's just like, okay, well, I was here playing my Commodore 64, so you guys have fun with your crash.
So, moving forward, should we talk about these micro games?
Oh, yeah.
We definitely should bring them up, because they are fascinating. I think that's where you really start getting the uniqueness of Asterix into video games. Yep. And it's kind of shocking to me how well some of these games captured that soul. The games themselves aren't necessarily the best, but what they did with the property circa like 86, 85, it's kind of unheard of, because it's still a time where games are, by and large, not very complex. We're still in the arcade era of mazes and things like this.
This first one, 86, Asterix et la Potion Magique, and that came out on what system?
That was like the Amstrad, right? And
it was so originally it was actually on the Thompson MO5, I think,
must be the first time that's ever been mentioned on this.
The Thompson MO5 was a French-based educational computer, I think, which had video games as well. It's something that probably John's wife used at some point in her education.
I've heard that before.
Right. So the Thompson MO5, its specs, I guess, can be similar to the ZX Spectrum, but it has more color. I think it has worse sound, though.
How can you have worse sound on ZX Spectrum? That's unbelievable to me. It must be horrible.
I don't remember off the top of my head now. It's been many years since I actually played this version of the game.
Right.
I don't think it even has music. It has some sound effects.
So the main difference with the Thompson versus some of those other machines, like the ZX Spectrum, is that it doesn't have the color clash issues.
Yes.
Right? So you can actually do, like, create proper colored graphics without all that weird artifacting everywhere.
And it looks really beautiful for the time, I think. Especially the Asterix.
Considering the platform it's on, it's nuts.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I was playing this back in the day, like, for when doing research, I was kind of shocked by how good it looked for something that came out. I think it was developed in 85, came out early 86. For a fairly small market. But this one is interesting because it's a screen-by-screen adventure puzzle game, I guess we could call it.
It's basically Dizzy, let's be honest.
Hell yeah, baby!
It's not Dizzy. Let's not bring that rotten egg into this discussion.
Dizzy. Excuse me, Dizzy. Please do not speak against Dizzy in my presence.
Stu's from the UK, Audie. Come on now. Don't insult Dizzy.
Yeah, you know what? I'll put that egg back in the basket.
Thank you.
I want nothing to do with it.
Yeah, your disdain for your disdain is disgusting. Disgusting.
No, you know, I crack that thing open and just step on it.
I'm looking at this Asterix game right now, and to be honest, it looks worse than Dizzy. So
no, it does not. It has a lovable main character. What are you saying?
Like, I can't believe this.
You look at Dizzy and you just want to throw the machine in the trash. You don't even want to play games on it.
Oh my god, what is happening?
Well, I mean, this came out before Dizzy. Let's be clear here.
This came out before Dizzy.
I'm shaking.
So it makes it automatically, you know, the forefather and better.
I'm absolutely shaking here.
But I mean, it seems like
the game is interesting.
Yeah, right. It does look interesting. You know, the annoying thing is, I'm looking at this and I'm getting a Proustian rush because those visuals are very familiar to me. Like, I almost feel like I might have played this at some point, but that's not really possible, is it?
It did come out on the Amstrad later on. It looks fairly different, though.
Right.
The Amstrad's graphic processing is.
I'm very impressed with the way that they've rendered, like, the grass and the trees, and, like, it's really well done.
Really well done, and the game itself, fairly open-ended. I guess you could say it's a Metroidvania.
Yeah.
It's not really, but it has early elements of what would eventually become Metroidvania.
Yeah, I mean, that's true of so many microcomputer games, of course.
Right.
The thing about this, though, is that these microcomputer games were created or produced by Cocktail Vision, which is a French company that had a lot of history with, they kind of got their start doing adaptations of sort of French BDs, it seems like. But I learned about them through a game called The Bizarre Adventures of Woodruff and the Schnibble, which was my first exposure to French style graphic adventures. And boy, is that a weird game.
We all know that one.
Oh my gosh.
Schnibble. Yep.
I mean, if I still can't stop going on about it, it's just a constant in our lives.
It is.
Yeah. But this game, I mean, so the basics of it, for even though we mentioned like stuff like Metroidvania and stuff, but it is screen to screen, getting items that you will need to unlock other areas and get over obstacles. There's not enemies per se as much as there are obstacles, which will need a potion, or, you know, you need to find a harp at some point.
They're all very sort of recognizable. Like, you've got, like, your Romans, you've got the boar that Obelix will be up to get the hide from, and you've got, like, Idifix, Cacophonix turns up, the bard turns up. It's all very impressive.
So, the thing I remember about this, too, was that it actually had an exclusive comic in it, and I tried for years to find a box copy of this, which is about as easy as finding the Holy Grail. And I've never found it, but they did re-release that comic in the Class Act?
Right.
So eventually it kind of went back and redistributed it. But for the longest time, there was, because the game itself is based off of La Potion Magique.
Yeah.
Which is, it's also the first animation is based of, which is one where they get, like, the beards. They make a fake potion for the Romans after he kidnapped them, and it makes their beards grow endlessly. not the best of the animations, but a funny premise, no less.
I'm still like looking at it. Like, there's so much I want to praise here. Like, this is like a game where you can freely switch to between Asterix and Obelix to solve puzzles whatever. But Obelix, they've absolutely nailed the way that Obelix walks with his hands behind his back, and it just looks so authentic to the comic. And then when you do get into a fight, you've got that big biff, bang, like boom, like cloud, with all legs and arms coming out of it. It's all just so brilliantly done. You know, it's right up there with Dizzy. It's that good.
Well,
so, the thing about this,
you can actually like this game though.
Oh yeah, this is never going to end. I'm just trying to get the last word in as a Dizzy lover, but I can't. It's not happening.
This game received some ports though. It did actually come to the Amstrad CPC, and that version, it's lower resolution, but I think the actual color choices are better.
I'm very fond of the way the CPC games look in general, so
I like the CPC look, but I think
it's chunkier for sure.
It's chunkier, and I kind of like the. I've always been, you know, I'll bring this up anytime I speak, but like Another World, this kind of idea of your mind filling out the blanks.
Yeah.
And when I look at stuff like the Spectrum and Thompson MO5 Asterix, that aspect is really appealing to me.
Your imagination has a lot of heavy lifting to do there.
Right. Yeah. And when you look at, like Stu has been saying, like you look at the screenshots for the MO5 version, it's almost like every screen. I could very much print that up, frame it, and it looks like something that was done artistically.
Oh yeah, but, I mean, I'm looking at the CPC version now, and while there are elements of it that are impressive, it looks much slower and more like agonizing to do anything almost.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, if I had to pick a version, I would definitely pick the MO5 version. I don't know if they've emulated that or not.
Yeah, there is an MO5 emulator out there, so you can enjoy every game on
French educational games. Just remember that if you do download any MO5 games, you need to delete them within 24 hours, otherwise you're breaking the law.
That's true. And they're very particular about this.
Yeah.
So do make sure to track down a copy of Asterix on MO5 if you want to play it more than an hour. It should be too hard to find.
Also on Micros, there was Asterix and the Magic Cauldron on Commodore 64, and that was 2 years later. One year later in 87.
That is one I remember myself playing. Yeah.
Yeah. How was your experience with that one?
Oh, it's been long ago. What I remember is it just looks very beautiful. I think again they nailed the characters. I just looked at the screenshot right now. Again with Obelix walking, hands behind the back. You can really recognize them. And one of the first games where I also learned English was this is where I learned that. That animal is called a boar in English.
Oh, interesting.
Right.
Here we go.
So it's an interesting game again. You know, it uses aspects that like the MO5 game also uses. It's an open-ended adventure game. Graphically, likenesses are really good. What's interesting to me about this game is, first of all, the action scenes. So the action scenes are direct input here. So there, you actually fight Romans and boars and whatnot, and it actually does a secondary window where you zoom in on the action and you get blockier sprites.
It's a little bit like the superhero games, like the Batman game where you go through different comic panels and such.
So it kind of brings up another panel, like a comic book. It zooms in the action and you kind of have this like one-on-one fighter mode, circa 1986 Europe. It's not the best playing game or anything, but I do think that, like, you know, you go into the village, for example, and the different villages are there, and they actually kind of have their own pace. You can't talk to them or anything, but they have their own kind of like sequences and things that they do. So it feels very alive for a game of this era. I love Uncommon 64. This is one of those games where it generates a screen by screen. So like it will draw the elements. Annoying in the sense if you want to just get through the game, but I just love seeing the scenes being generated that way.
It does seem like it would get exhausting.
Leaderboard Golf is another one.
The Last Ninja.
Last Ninja did the same. Yeah. It's just today I find it kind of like artistic, whereas back then.
I mean, it's awesome. I totally agree.
Yeah. But
it was a smart thing.
It's another one where it's like, it's not as open ended, I think, as it first comes off as, because you have like an open world. You can just kind of step out and do whatever you want. Whereas you still kind of need the linearity. You have to find, I think you have to find the 7 pieces of the cauldron, if I remember correctly. I think that's the final objective. And, if you get beaten by the Romans, you actually get captured and you have to, get yourself out of jail, which is another aspect from the comic books, which happens.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see kind of like these different inspirations they take from the source material. And, you know, again, it's like 1986. Even when you look at something like the NES, generally, property games at this time can only really have likeness, but not so much else. It becomes very generic very quickly.
Yeah.
A platformer or something like this. Whereas here, you have like this adventure game that tries to bring all these aspects of the comic book into the game as gameplay mechanics.
It looks like it does a pretty good job, I would say. Like, I'm impressed by what I'm seeing here.
Yeah, it's not bad. But it's also, it is a bit cumbersome, and the open-ended nature of it, back then, you know, it was all about communication. You generally had friends.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a Zelda thing where it's like, you're supposed to talk on the school ground about where, like, oh, I went there and I found
this. Where's the piece of the cauldron? Yeah, yeah.
And this is an aspect that just is completely lost on games today. And then we get that terrible saying that it hasn't aged well. It's just, you know, it's of a different era, of a different mentality that, like, this is something that you're supposed to share.
I don't believe in that as a premise in general, just, like, badly aged. I mean, I think we're on the level with a lot of things, with the exception of Dizzy. I'm happy to put that aside, but I think otherwise we do agree on a lot of aspects of retro gaming here, and that's nice.
The one thing we should point out about this game, have you heard the music for this game?
No. Is it your Commodore 64 kind of SID chip?
So this one is crazy. So it's actually done by Neil Brennan, who did fantastic scores, including Usagi Yimbo on Commodore 64.
Oh, yeah. We've played that.
And he generally fantastic composer, but this one is like... I think I explained it back then. It's like, it sounds like a sea shanty with like death metal percussion.
It actually kind of does. Like, I'm listening to it now.
Yeah, it sounds like a man that's just on like, what's that, the French instrument called in English? The one where you push it together.
A bicycle with a baguette attached to it.
That's not an instrument. That's just a lifestyle.
A ring of onions, a ring of garlic around someone who's wearing a black and
accordion.
White stripy top.
Accordion. Okay.
Accordion.
Yes.
It's an accordion. Okay. Yeah, it sounds like a man on an accordion in the wind with like death metal percussion next to him. So it's a crazy soundtrack. Go listen to it. It's just unlike anything else.
I think our beloved editor will probably splice some of that music into this episode so everyone can enjoy it.
Right. Well, enjoy. That's all I can say.
Getting off the microcomputers, we're moving on.
We forgot one, right? Isn't there the Magic Carpet game?
So there are a couple of others, actually. And also, the Magic Cauldron might be some American people that might have played it under a different name. It was called Ardok in America, and was changed to like a barbarian game.
Right, right.
It has nothing to do with Aztecs at that point. They changed all the sprites.
Scum.
And
Ardok. The Barbarian.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with Psygnosis Barbarian.
You know, it's not. I do remember that Ardok has like a very cool like box art cover. It's like a man wearing like a fur coat or something with a sword.
But it looks like it was like filmed or like shot in somebody's backyard, like during the
fall. In Spain in 1971. Yes.
Yeah, it really does.
It just looks like a Italian like sword and sorcery film from like the 70s.
It's kind of badass.
It's fantastic. I want a poster of it. But yeah, there were definitely other microcomputer games. Generally, there were adventure games. There was one in Germany that was fan made, which was it was published in a magazine by Marketing Technik, I think.
Yeah, that's one thing that exists. Markt und Technik.
Wow.
They made a Commodore 64 magazine. I think it was 64 magazine. 64?
Yeah.
And they put out a adventure game on that, I remember. It's fairly straightforward. There was the Gerhazad, which is the Magic Carpet. That's like
That's like more of a visual novel, right? And that was also done by Cocktail Vision. And it's mostly focused on, it has a lot of full screen artwork, but it also has this like overhead game that you can play as well.
I seem to recall it had like a map feature. It's been a very long time since I played this.
That one actually came out on Atari ST, Amiga, and DOS, among others.
Did it?
So it actually has some more, it's where you start to get into visuals more resembling 16-bit, right? Like it's more identifiable.
Yeah, I think that was kind of, because there are a few others that I don't think I covered in my article back then, because I remember in Germany I found a couple other kind of story-based
games. There was like an Amiga CD32, like, CD.
That's Learn English with asterisks.
Yes.
That was a CDTV release, which, I have those, which was a PC CDTV release, Learn English with asterisks, and Learn English with asterisks and his son. But the microcomputer games outside of the Thompson MO5 and the Commodore 64 games are mostly just adventure games. And at that, they're very straightforward, just kind of reading experiences with some like map features where you can kind of pick where you go next, but very little interactivity.
But following, if we can get to the consoles, or at least this a console.
Well, I was thinking there was also Cocktail Vision did a bunch of these. Didn't they also do one that was more like they did an Amiga game that was more like action based? I'm forgetting the name on that one.
Le Coup de Menhir.
Yes.
Asterix and the Big Fight, which is based on the cartoon at the time. It's one of the few tie-ins that they ever did to an actual cartoon release.
There's a game called Operation Get a Fix.
Oh, that's the game. That's the same one.
Operation Get a Fix, which was the movie was called Asterix and the Big Fight.
Yeah.
That's based on the cartoon that came out. It's based on the album The Soothsayer, but the movie takes a lot of deviations from that.
The very thing is, back then, many of the movies just combined two albums into one movie back in the day.
Two or three.
The thing about that, though, is like this really showcases the pixel art capabilities of Cocktail Vision.
Yeah.
Like, it looks phenomenal, I think, for an 89 game, I think it came out. Like, just there's so much detail in the scenes. It's like beautiful color usage, great animation.
Yeah.
Like, it is more adventurish overall, but it's still just this, like, gorgeous-looking thing.
Yeah, so, I mean, this Amiga game, I actually got this when it came out, and I was fairly disappointed in it, because I had, from the impressions I had from the magazines and kind of the screenshots, was that we were looking at something like a Monkey Island situation, kind of like a point-and-click adventure game with some action aspects.
Has that ever actually happened with Asterix? Telltale presents Asterix, what the hell?
I mean, so many IPs would just be served so good with a good point-and-click adventure, I think, but it's just not
Asterix
big enough.
Asterix is probably on the top of that list, though. I mean, especially of the era.
I mean, Asterix, it lives by the jokes and by the humor and the wordplay, and you could use that so well in a good
point-and-click
game.
Yeah.
But looking at Operation Getafix, I mean, you're so slow-moving in this game. Like, to get anywhere, it's just taking forever.
I love the graphics again, though, in it, though. Like, again, there's, like, some scenes where it's just, like, if you cut out the UI section and just, like, frame it, it's, like, beautiful pixel art.
Beautiful.
And it has some cutscenes from the film, which, interesting, again, it's one of the very few Asterix games that directly ties into one of the cartoons, which in a US marketplace would be kind of unheard of. But for us in Europe, I don't remember that many European properties, like film properties, getting tie-ins right away.
So I guess for those listening, we should probably spell out what this game is versus the others. Mm. And it seems it's more of the type of game where you're exploring the environment, looking for items, and you can move up and down, left and right, but it's still flip screen based. So you'll like say walk to the right. There's enemies and things just like in your way, obstacles, and you're just kind of moving and jumping and getting past them to the next screen while finding the objects that you need to obtain. And I think the big problem with it is that it's just very slow paced.
It's right? Extremely slow.
Like,
yeah,
really just, slow.
And you will have several screens where you literally have nothing happening. There's no character. There's no item. And I think it became very confusing to people, just kind of like, well, what's up with, like, because there can be 3-4 of these screens in a row where it's just like, well, there has to be something here. And like, there is nothing there.
The thing I will give it, though, is that they try to do some cool stuff with the different abilities you have access to. Like Asterix can like point in the air when standing in front of a guard, causing the guard to look up in the sky. And yes. You're basically trying to confuse them. And then eventually they can get scared and run away with their hands up. So it's like a non-violent approach to get past them that's kind of in tune with the comics, right? I think that's cool.
Well, it's in tune with the movie, and there are events in the game where like things fly down, because what happens in the movie and in the album is that Panoramix gets hit by a rock because Obelix drops it on him, and he goes crazy. He goes absolutely nuts. If you watch that cartoon, if you ever seen the Simpsons episode where Homer eats the pepper,
oh yeah,
it's basically that, but feature length.
True classic.
And even more crazy. So go watch it. But he just ends up making all these crazy potions, which just end up being catastrophical for everyone around him.
Especially for that one Roman guy.
Yeah.
One of the Romans starts flying. He turns into a balloon. It's a crazy scene, man. And that's the one thing that's really funny about the Asterix cartoons, is that they're way more experimental than what Disney would ever allow.
All I can say is I think if you watch today Asterix and Cleopatra, this thing is just a huge trip, the whole movie.
There's 12 tasks. There's another one.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Permit 838, that's still a thing in Germany.
It's a thing in Europe, yeah, which we won't go into, but that's an aspect that, like, it's still kind of, it turned into a cultural thing, that scene from that cartoon.
Yeah.
That's how impactful that movie was on a continent, which just shows you, like, Asterix was not a curiosity. It was a very impactful property.
I mean, thinking about that, I just can say for myself, there is quotes from Asterix that have become part of my everyday speaking patterns in a way. So certain quotes and certain things that they said, it's just a thing. Which again shows how big it is and how well written it is, of course.
Yeah.
They even got a theme park out of it.
Even that.
I had never been there. I want to go so bad.
Yeah, same.
That's
same.
Of all the places I've been in the world, I've never been to Parc Asterix, and I don't know why.
I want to go there, and I want to go to the Moomin one.
Last week, I was at Nintendo World in Los Angeles. And, like, man, just that experience, I lost my breath stepping in. There's not much to do there, but just stepping in. And I think I would have somewhat similar feelings about Parc Asterix, even though it is not as elaborate as what Super Nintendo World is.
Mm. No.
Not at all. Maybe I feel like we should arrange a trip there sometime. It's not that far.
Oh, right? Yeah. I would love to. Yeah, yeah.
If that happens, count me in.
Just check the map. It's pretty much... It's halfway between all of us, if Audi comes to Germany.
There we go.
I'm coming there next week as of this recording.
Excellent.
Road trip. Thank you. Okay, so are we? Is there more to say about these micro games, or are we moving on to consoles?
You know, I think summing it up, the microcomputers definitely introduced a lot of interesting gameplay mechanics that were unique for the property and for the consoles. Yeah. A lot of adventure elements.
And what we've got next is such an to me, a very unlikely thing to have happened, which is Asterix for the Master System. The Master System Asterix game on 1991. Now, when this dropped, it was highly acclaimed in the UK as one of the best games
in Germany
for the Master
as well.
System.
Very popular in Germany.
Yeah, same throughout Europe.
And this is a game that's made by Sega Japan.
Yep.
Yeah, it's made by Sims,
so
right?
How the hell did that happen? That seems so unlikely.
So the Master System had an especially good marketplace in Europe and South America. And I think to maintain that strength, especially in the Central European market like Germany, France, Sweden was a big market where Asterix was big. And as you mentioned, the UK as well, like Asterix was huge. So I think Sega, unlike Nintendo and other manufacturers, they were very smart at this time by focusing on, okay, we have these specific markets which we are strong in. How can we cater even stronger to them? And they found this property in Asterix.
This is also how we got the Otifants.
This is also how we got the Otifants, unfortunately.
Sorry, John. I had to get that reference in.
Yeah.
We should clarify that Otifants has no impact on Europe and has absolutely no value as a property.
Hmm. Are you saying that Otifants is shite? Is that what you're saying? It just sucks. It's bad.
I'm saying that Otifants is quite shite.
Hmm.
I won't deign this with an answer.
You're just rolling in. You don't care who you upset. You go after Dizzy, you go after the Otifants.
I'm done, people. I'm done being nice. Dizzy and Otifants. What kind of show?
Find something John loves and denigrate that. Because John's currently sitting there, arms folded.
Don't you dare attack Wonder Dog.
You know what? John has given me my career, so I'll be nice to him.
Yeah, that makes
all
sense.
Right.
I think it's generally hard to upset him. That's a problem.
This is why I pretend to like Prog when I'm talking to Parrish.
You know. But the only thing John still owes me is that we are still to do an Asterix DF Retro where we dress up as Asterix and Obelix.
That sounds really fun.
Respectively.
I just got to find those pants.
So we
got to
find those pants. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where are those pants? Tell us, where are those pants? But yeah, so the Master System, I think if you look at South America, because I lived in Brazil for a while, and I was kind of stunned. I lived in Brazil from 2005 to 2007. And at that time, still, you could find Master... I'm really angry about this today, because you could find Master System games on shelves still. And I didn't buy any of them, because I just looked at them and was like, why would anyone buy this at this point?
Oh, no.
Okay. And I remember seeing like Street Fighter... Legend of Evolution, these games, kind of for pennies. I should have bought them.
Oh, dear.
But they did the same there, where it actually the Asterix game that came out in Europe was converted to a Brazilian comic book. It's not Monica.
But if I can just butt in, wasn't that the second game?
That might be the second game.
I think the first one stayed Asterix in Brazil. The second one was adapted.
You're right. You're absolutely
not
right.
Monica,
Tectoy did put out Asterix as is. The second game was converted to not Monica. It was another one with a dog. I don't remember it, but I remember seeing it. But yeah, Tectoy did put out the first Asterix game as Asterix Master System. But this is like the brilliance of Sega at the time. Just kind of finding these local properties and putting their strength behind it.
Because and putting really good people on
it. The market would respond.
That is the big thing. I checked the credits again, and we have some serious names behind that. I mean, there's Tomose Endo, and you might recall, if these podcasts are put out in order, this man was very influential in the Castle of Illusion games on Master System.
I mean, when you look at Asterix Master System, you look at, like, the HUD, it's like, that's the same one as Castle of Illusion. I like this game. I don't think I love it as much as some people seem to, but that's
like I do.
Yeah, I do like it, and I do think if I spent more time with it, I might like it more. But I think Castle of Illusion spoiled me a little bit because it's just that much smoother.
Yeah, I mean, lessons learned, right?
Yeah,
Because this, I think this came out slightly before Castle of Illusion, and
it was the same year. Well, no, Castle of Illusion. No, wait. Master System version of Castle of Illusion came a year before this. The same programmer that did Asterix also did Castle of Illusion and Land of Illusion on Master System and Game Gear. So
yeah, that's Tomosa Endo, the one I mentioned.
He did this between those two.
Yeah,
I mean that's not me criticizing this. This is an excellent 8-bit game, obviously. Yeah. Like it's full of variety. Yeah. It plays really well. Is this the one
where
when you play as Asterix, when you press attack, he does the wind-up punch every time? Like,
that's
he spins his
fist.
Okay, because that's what annoys me. That's what I'm thinking of. Okay, this one's fine.
Yeah, okay, so that's the second. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So, another name...
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Another name I want to drop is the composer by Takayuki Nakamura did the music, who also worked on E-SWAT, on Virtua Fighter, on Trouble 2, and on Prepare Everybody for... having this name pronounced correctly for the first time on Retronaut, Ehrgeiz, God Bless the Ring.
Oh, you did it.
You're welcome.
Can we also talk about Einhander, just to get that correct?
Thank you very much.
Einhander. Einhander, it sounds like a euphemism. Hey,
I would like to chime in quickly here, because I played through this game with Thomas for the first time this year.
Yeah.
We played all the way through it in one sitting.
Cool.
And I walked away pretty impressed, because one, it looks fantastic. The sprite work, the size of the sprites, like it's shockingly good. And I think like the color usage looks almost 16-bit. Like there aren't sprites of characters on like the NES that look this good in terms of the color usage. It's just perfect. It looks great.
I'll just have some wonderful up the backgrounds, I think.
Yeah, the backgrounds, you know, those are decidedly 8-bit Master System quality, but there's a ton of detail in them. They're very, very nice looking.
I think it varies. There are some that are rather boring. You have just a house, the inside, and it's just the walls. But there's other ones when you have this nighttime stage with the bluish sky and everything that looks just brilliant, I think.
Mm. But they have some, you know, it is a fairly simple game, but there's some cool mechanics. Like you can throw these items on like the lava or the water that become a raft, and you can kind of move your way across there. There's cool springboards and spots. You know, you're kind of throwing potions basically.
Yeah.
So your means of like dealing with challenges is a little different than a traditional platformer, but I think it's pretty fun. It works well.
It depends on kind of which character you use, how you go through a stage.
That's right.
So there is variety, because it is a traditional platform in the sense of like a kind of like a Mario Brothers. That kind of, it's not exactly like Mario Brothers, but like, you know, the left to right kind of standard platformer. But they do throw in a lot of variables and a lot of diversity that you weren't seeing so much,
including nice verticality.
Yeah.
The thing I remember was that some stages could be like really hard with one character and you'd just be getting annoyed and then you switch to the other and it's completely different and often easier. So I found that we were kind of going back and forth between the characters per stage depending on what was going on, which is nice.
You have to choose before the stage starts, so you have to guess for the first time, of course, but it's doable.
There's some tricky jumps later in the game, I remember, that's for sure. Yeah.
It's definitely tougher than Castle of Illusion was, in my opinion. Yeah,
it's slightly tougher.
Lots of moving platforms all over the place.
This is the first game where you can even play as Edifex, right? Because there's a bonus stage where you control him.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Which was a big deal, I remember. Like, it sounds silly, but I remember the magazines kind of pointed out that, like, the fan favorite can now be controlled.
So the thing, Audie, that I want to mention, because earlier you discussed, like, your impression of Asterix as it was perceived by Japan, right? And I think this is a showcase of how impressive this development team is, in that both with Mickey Mouse, with Asterix, and other properties, how well they're able to adapt them to their own game.
Yeah.
And it feels like they know the franchise. And I guess they probably learned it for the project, but it really feels respectful.
what's really interesting about Aspect is that you look at when it comes from either the French or the UK developers, they looked at it and they wanted to kind of get the vastness of Asterix into a video game. So it's always like adventure based, kind of fetch quests, because that's how the comics are kind of in a sense, they are often fetch quests. They have to go somewhere to help someone, somewhere else, or get something for a potion or these kinds of things. And that's kind of the takeaway. In Japan, they looked at just the different aspects of how it could be turned into gameplay mechanics. In an action sense, they looked at the fighting, they looked at the kind of adventuring as traversing a platforming stage. It's also very interesting to see that mentality.
What characters can we put in as an enemy, maybe? Who works?
Right. I mean, for most part, that's really easy because it's just different Romans, right?
But yeah, but you also have, for example, that remember that guy from Assassin's Legionary with a huge coat?
Yep.
And the Horned Helmet, he's in that game, for example. This is a guy who appears in one comic for two or three panels, maybe, and that's it. And he is in there.
Yes, I'm guessing I remember I talked to the creators of the Ninja Turtles games at Konami many years ago.
Of course you did.
And the way that was handled was that they got a lot of referential materials, but they didn't read the comic necessarily or anything like that. I'm guessing for Sims it was similar, that they probably got a lot of images and kind of materials to look at. So you do get these kind of like off the wall choices like that.
Yeah.
And not because so much that they read through every album and found like, well, that character's cool, but just because like that was one of the people that was in the materials they got and was like, well, he looks cool. And it kind of comes, you know, he's put into the game somewhat out of character sometimes, not necessarily in Asterix, but in other properties Ninja Turtles. So I think that's how that was handled. But it certainly is an extremely impressive effort from a Japanese company. Just how they also, the look of the characters, you know, John mentioned just the sprite work and the color usage, but the actual, like, appropriation of the characters into this graphic style is kind of, it's somewhat like chibi like not quite, but you know, they are definitely changed to fit this art direction that they went with, and it's such a perfect representation
just to fit the Master System's capabilities for the sprites.
That's something. I mean, that
getting a proper sized Obelix on the Master System, I think that's quite a challenge.
I mean, two playable characters with such different sprite sizes and contour is just like, it's not as simple as it sounds, but they totally nailed it.
Yeah.
So I was always super impressed. This was one of my favorite games growing up. And I've always held very dear that like, this is one of the best games that Sega put out during this era. Now, unfortunately, I believe this is one of those games that can't be played on NTSC system. So this was one of those that you can't even import.
Can you though? We
did play it on my Japanese Mega Drive, but I have a region mod in that, and I don't remember switching to 50 Hertz though.
Yeah.
I'll have to double check.
There's one of them that is certainly the NES games.
Yeah.
Have issues with 60, unless you use the ROM. Was meant for the American market, but like, there is one of the Master System games that I know have issues in NTSC.
Maybe the second one. I'll have to try. Some Master System games, they all tend to work on NTSC systems, but if they're too fast, certain things break.
We find out.
Although maybe, Thomas, I was thinking about the actual enemy of this game, the main villain, are those wooden spikes with the floating platform.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm wondering if maybe we were playing in NTSC mode and it was actually harder than it was supposed to be. Because
That could be.
That part was bad.
But we mentioned it.
We've learned this over time. Remember when we played Mario Millard, Donald Duck game?
Exactly.
That was a 50 Hertz game that we tried to force into 60,
it seemed to work. It was fine, but then you get to that one part where you need to make this precise jump, and the timing was so fast that it was almost impossible. I was like, this game is horribly balanced, but then we realized if you played in 50 Hertz, it's just fine.
We talked about it on the Donald Duck episode, but Mario Millard is, there is actually a hack that makes it work at 60 Hertz, so like, there's a more powerful hack,
There was a Brazilian version of it that runs at PAL 60.
To get back to Asterix quickly, I think I would be very surprised if they actually developed that game in 50 hertz or with a 50 hertz goal, because, I mean, it is not an important game for Sega Japan, and it did not probably take too long to make it. I put in a lot of love and effort, but I don't think they worked towards a 50 hertz optimization here.
It's just interesting that this game was only released really in PAL territories, right? Like, that was the, that was the intended market.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're right. When developing it, they probably didn't have 50 hertz PAL televisions.
I would be surprised if they did.
Yeah. So I don't know. Those things always, I always wondered about how stuff like that were made.
John, we will track down Endo in Japan and ask him directly.
Yeah.
Here's the plan. So maybe about my experience with that game, it was the first game I ever played in the Master System.
Oh, wow.
And I think this game also spoiled me for many of the other games that came before, because honestly, it feels like an almost 16-bit game in places.
Yeah.
So the down from Mega Drive was not that big. And then I played games later, like Action Fighter, for example, the more simple earlier ones. And
God, I love Action Fighter so much.
It's a great game, but if you played it after you played Asterix, the Master System, it feels quite archaic and quite simple.
It does, yeah. So this was actually the first Asterix game I ever played, because I got into the series late, and only because of Audi, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, moving to Europe, I became aware of Asterix pretty quickly, and my wife loves it, but I wasn't really into the games. And then this was one of the first games that I believe Audi recommended I should get for the Master System.
It's also one of the few games in your collection, right? For the Master
System. Yeah, I don't have many Master System games, but this is one of them.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, nice. It's definitely, if you have, even if, like, Asterix aside, if you just want to get into Master System,
yeah,
like, this is one of those.
It's a must play.
Yeah.
It is like Thomas says, though, it definitely spoils you for the rest of the console, because this could, for me, fly as a very early Genesis game.
Yeah.
Like, it's simplistic. It looks, in many ways, it looks like an 8-bit game, but it plays and feels very much like that transition time from 8 to 16-bit gaming.
I'm just surprised this didn't get a Game Gear release as well.
That
is actually quite surprising. The other ones, at least the other ones did, right? The 8-bit ones.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But this one didn't.
Also, one thing I find remarkable is also the game is lavish in a way. They just put in these small set pieces for just one level. You get an entirely new tile set that is only used once in the entire game. I mean, there is this one scene with the giant octopus, which is a bit unexpected. You are underwater, that octopus sucks you in through its mouth, whatever, and then you have one level inside, and that's it. And I mean, that's...
Yeah.
There's also the chariot race.
That was the next one I want to mention. Yeah. And I mean, you don't have much memory in these cartridges. I mean, how big is that game? It's maybe 2 MB, I'd say.
Oh, I don't know.
So that's quite impressive to me, that they just put in all that stuff that needn't have been there in the end.
And it, you know, it feels like this could have been like almost like a swan song for the system, but we have more.
Yep.
A sequel to this directly.
Quite a lot more, yeah. And we'll get into that, because the next game, if we're ready to move on to that one.
I think so.
Actually, real quick, I was looking at dumps of Master System ROMs, and you can actually sort by ROM size.
Okay, what
happened? All the Asterix games are among the large. They sort in terms of. They use the biggest ROM size aside from 5 games: Virtua Fighter Animation, Jangpung 3, 4-Pack All Action, and a couple others. Those use cartridges that are larger, but other than that, the Asterix games use the largest available cartridge on Master System.
Jangpung 3 is a Street Fighter, Korean Street Fighter knockoff.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
So, do you have a ROM size for us? So, it would be 4 MB.
Oh, it looks to be 512 kilobytes. So, whatever that is in megabit.
It's for Ambitch, yep. Like Phantasy Star.
I always found it funny when games would be promoted that way, like, this is an 8 megabit cartridge. You'd be like, what? Like, what does that even mean? I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, it's a 4 megabit cartridge. So those other games would have used 8 megabit cartridges. Those are the largest.
Yeah.
Okay. Good to know. Thank you.
Actually, also, speaking on that, those large cartridges, the 8 megabit ones, were only released in Brazil, Korea, and Australia.
Oh.
Australia. So
there was no 8 megabit game released outside of those regions for the Master System.
Yeah. Sounds about right.
How about that?
So, following the Master System, we're jumping here to something very different. We will, of course, return to home consoles, but the next game in 1992 was Asterix, the arcade coin-op, the machine.
Oh, man.
Produced by Konami in the tradition of their belt scrollers, such as, I want to say X-Men, I want to say The Simpsons, you know?
Turtles.
Yeah, Turtles. Actually, how did I miss the Turtles? Jesus Christ.
Yeah, so X-Men and Simpsons run on a very early framework. This game runs directly on the same framework that would power Turtles in Time.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So can we agree on two things here? One, it's probably the best Konami brawler, and second, it's the best Asterix game.
No, I don't agree to either of those.
So I would say that it's absolutely among my favorite of the Konami brawlers, because as much as I love the Turtles games, I do find that the Konami belt scrollers have a weightlessness to them. I don't like the hit detection often.
I know what you mean, yeah.
Would it be a cheating if I said my favorite is Buck Your Hair? Because that's kind of a shooter, right?
No, I love great. Buck Your Hair, but it's more like a shooter.
Actually,
love Buck Your Hair.
We
should do an episode on Buck Your Hair.
Yes, 100%, yeah.
Let me interject here real quick on that, though. You mentioned the arcade board. So this is the arcade board running it, just to get an idea of how this compares. This is the same board that was also used in the game ZexX, the shooter. It was used in Wild West Cowboys of Moo Mesa, Run and Gun, Lethal Enforcers, Bucky O'Hare, and a few others, G.I. Joe. So
The GX board, right?
No, the GX came after. That's the one that powered Salamander 2 and everything. So this is the one.
Is G.I. Joe the one that's kind of into the screen, scaling kind of?
Precisely.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool
game. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So as you can see, this was like their early 90s, but pretty powerful board, I would say. A huge improvement over what they had before.
I've never actually played this on a legit machine, and I'd like to, because I imagine it's a better experience.
I had
experience.
One in my town.
Oh, wow.
Same, yeah.
Oh, man, I love this game, and what I love so much about it was that I just mentioned, like, with the Turtles games, the hit detection, and, like, the floatiness of it all, I never quite liked it. I just loved the property so much I could overlook it. But in the Asterix game, they actually sort of fixed this, and it's a much more impactful belt scroller. The hit detection, the hit boxes are really on point. It's among the best Konami ever did. And in terms of just the representation of the source material, like, even in comparison to something like Turtles, which is near perfect.
Yeah. Well, this is a spectacular looking game for sure. Yeah.
This might be the perfect game. And that's, you know, you could argue that it's best action game just because, like, seldom do you get a game that nails the source material this well, because the source material is so good for a belt scroller.
Yep.
Like, there are scenes in the comic book, in the cartoons, where they literally are just walking towards hordes of enemies that all look the same. It's the exact same concept. And in video game form, then it feels almost like you're taking part in one of the comics. And the presentation overall, where they use the comic book panels to present the story, they use samples from the original voice actors, from the, I think it's the UK dub, if
right.
I don't remember incorrectly, that they used. And they even had, Uderzo oversee some of the designs. Again, I mentioned I had interviewed, Turtles team back in the day, and I did get to talk to them about this a little bit as well. And it was shocking to me how little they knew.
Wow.
Because this is a property, again, Konami was on the hunt for anything that had a recognizable name, because Capcom was doing the same. Literally every company had started doing this by the late 80s. Ninja Turtles had been such a success that Konami's whole company mantra had changed to, basically, we're the Ninja Turtles company.
That was the catalyst, though, right? Like, Ninja Turtles hit huge, so they're like, okay, this is our future now.
No, they openly said to me that, like, the Ninja Turtles changed how Konami looked at their forecasting and their lineups. Yeah, and, like, so it all changed to, like, the Bucky O'Hears and other properties and Asterix.
Yeah, it was Cowboys and Moo Mesa, let me tell you.
Well,
it's a good game. Moo Mesa, it's a goddamn good game.
It is a good game.
It's a really good game. It's like a Sunset Riders sequel.
Sunset Riders 2, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, well, Mystic Warriors is probably more of the direct sequel to Sunset Riders, but it's in that course, lineage. Yeah. And again, you know, Moo Mesa, we joke about it, but that was like, you know, a comic book that came from one of the illustrators for Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, right.
It was like really far out there, but it was still like some sort of property with some sort of naming. It was getting a cartoon, which had like a season, and they made a game out of it, which is really good. But yeah, with the Asterix thing here, they got materials to look at. They thought it was cool. They kind of, again, I think it's just that kind of Japanese design mentality of kind of getting these key features, these key scenes, these key frames of these properties and getting them into the game. Because you have several sprites here that are like picture perfect from how they look in the comic books.
Especially the Roman centurions.
Things like that. Yep. Yeah, the Romans.
With a golden
everything
armor.
Is on point.
Yep.
Even the chariot races back as a button masher. You're on the pirate ship. I think you go to the pyramid. Like, you have every stage is based on an album, a different album. Yeah. So you kind of go through this timeline-ish of Asterix, and it's just a spectacle. It's one of the craziest belt scrollers that they've done. There's so much going on screen. Even when you start the game, you're in the village. You have all these secondary characters rooting you on, just like in the cartoons and the comics. And it never lets up. From the regular enemies to the boss fights, there's constantly something going on, but it's all appropriate for the source material.
Could I say my experience with this game, like, you're making me want to go back to it because I remember not loving it. Like, I remember getting kind of bored with it. But then again, I think that kind of happens with all these belt scrolls eventually. So what I probably should do, because I played it on MAME. I've never found a machine in my life at this game. But maybe if I tune the difficulty down a bit, I'll enjoy it more. I mean, playing it on two player, it was great, but it just seemed to be so difficult.
Well, maybe I can help you there because I played the original machine only a few weeks ago. I was in Lyon with Bandai Namco, and there is this one game shop. John told me to go there, they have this tiny arcade in the back, and there is one Tekken machine, there is one other thing, and there is one, of course, it's his friends, one Asterix with the original machine with a CRT in it, and this was just wonderful. It was just a blast.
It is wonderful, yeah. Well, I mean, I have such fond memories of playing the Simpsons game.
Sure,
That overrides this for me, but that's only because I've never played it on an actual stand-up arcade, and I reckon if I did, I would probably fall in love with it.
The important thing to keep in mind when looking at a game like this, so people listening, you're probably not seeing the game right now, right? This is a game that I would say was at the tail end of the brawler mania that started with Final Fight and Double Dragon kind of kicking things off, right? Like, these games were no longer a huge draw, by and large, mainly due to Street Fighter, I would say.
Yeah.
And as a result, you know, most of the ones that people remember, like the Turtles, Simpsons, a lot of stuff, and from other companies as well, they're not as visually striking as this. This is like top tier sprite work on par with the kind of stuff you would see on maybe Saturn and PlayStation era, right? Like, this is really high-end pixel art.
It genuinely shocks me that they didn't even try to port this. They didn't even do like a Hyperstone heist on it. They just did nothing with it. That wild to me. Absolutely wild.
It is crazy because when I talked to them about it, I came in with the kind of feeling that this probably wasn't that successful, probably limited to certain markets. And I mean, I remembered it from my hometown. We had a cabinet. But so, like, my feeling was that, like, well, this is one of the best games Konami ever made for arcade and all this. And they actually mentioned that, like, no, it made quite a lot of money in the European market. It did get cabinets released in Japan and South America.
Yeah.
So, like, they made money of it. So, but I think the reason why they never did a home port was that Asterix was very early out there with kind of like that Tetris kind of deal where they separated the licensing very strongly between what kind of platforms you were releasing on. So handhelds, home consoles, arcade, home computers, these were all treated with separate licenses.
That's worth noting, though, is that Konami did in fact release a handheld version of Asterix.
They did an LCD version, yes.
Yes, they did.
Okay, fair play.
Which, they did a lot of those, didn't they? And this is not, this is a different one.
Bucky.
It's sort of Turtles. A wide layout versus that, because a lot of the Konami games, LCD games with this, a really long and tall, skinny shell.
Yes.
Like Turtles.
Yeah, yeah.
Or this is a different format, but they did it, which I thought was interesting.
Nothing will ever be as good as the one they made for Doug that says Doug Faster on one of the buttons.
Doug Faster.
Yeah.
That's right.
I fucking hate Doug.
I hate Doug too.
I hope Doug dies. There, I said it.
It already did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer around.
Yeah, that's an abomination. The Doug LCD game basically looks like one of those controllers, like my first controller made for like 2-year-olds, you know, where it's just got all like the weird colored shapes on it. And you press buttons.
Like the Fisher Price kind of thing.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
I just want to know what it means to Doug Faster. How does one Doug Faster?
There's separate buttons. One is
Don't ruin it.
It's funnier
there's
that
Doug
way.
Button, there's a faster. Button.
There's a faster button and a Doug button. Doug button.
Yeah. So what does it mean to Doug?
So what does a Doug button do?
You just
Doug
exactly his own grave. I don't know.
I you know what's funny about the LCD games? There's been videos about this from YouTubers and whatnot, but like, I find them so fascinating that most of my time spent in MAME the last like 3 years has been playing LCD games because they finally started emulating them. It's just such a wild. Remember, John, when we did Mortal Kombat, the DF Retro episode?
Yeah.
Like of my first things I told you was like, we are going to include the LCD game. And you were like, yeah, obviously.
I love getting LCD games in there.
Yeah. It was like, it's terrible, but it just kind of creates this overall picture of popularity. It's just like, it was popular enough that people were this desperate to get their hands on interactive entertainment based on this property that they would buy.
I would,
the LCD game.
To get sort of off this and back on track, no offense meant there. LCD games is a subject I am interested in covering at some point. I think there is an episode.
Oh, man.
So I'm going to have to rope you in for that.
I think we've all had our share of those. I mean, I still have my old LCD games.
Them.
I have Sonic the Hedgehog. I have the Rocketeer. I have
the Rocketeer.
Have the Rocketeer.
Christ.
Also, I have Jordan versus Bird.
Amazing.
And then I have one that's just called like Pinball. But what's even better is that I got a whole bunch of these French LCD games from the early 80s that my wife
had as a kid
that look a lot like a Nintendo Game & Watch systems. And nice. Those are
I have some of those
wild.
Too.
It's so interesting.
I have the Ninja Turtles ones. I have Bucky one. And I have, when I lived in Japan, I bought this Ninja Turtles calculator, which has an exclusive LCD game on it.
Okay, now that is the deepest cut I've ever heard.
Wow. This is happening. Retronauts LCD games, keep an ear out for that, folks. Now, Asterix, though, we must be there must be more to say about the arcade game. Like, what's
The music.
Yeah, the music as well.
Also, the sound effects and music is just perfect. It's done by Izumi-san, who did the Turtles and those kind of soundtracks.
Yeah.
So, again, it has this really punchy, beefy sound. But it's very, like in the Turtles, it's very rock oriented, and based around the the main theme a lot. Whereas this has a lot more variation in the music, and it's unlike most of the Konami Bell Scroller soundtracks. It integrates a lot more instrumentations, a lot more ethnic sounds.
I mean, the thing is,
there's a lot of voices.
They had less to work with, I think, because Asterix does not have this one, I would say, cohesive soundscape at this point.
It doesn't.
I mean, I associate it with a certain sound, but that's something we'll get to eventually. Yeah.
Right. I mean, so you had like Yoo-hoo, which is like his catchphrase in a couple of. Like, you could hear it in a couple of movies and whatnot, but so they used that. And there was a theme song by this time in French, which was Asterix et là.
Asterix et là. I love that song.
Yeah, which was sung by, I forget his name, but he was a famous children's singer in France. And then that was actually covered by a British band for Asterix et Breton. So, what was that called? Lookout is Out? So they could have used that, I guess, kind of like Pizza Power. But Pizza you are right Power. That, yeah, sorry. I mean, they could have gone something like that.
Sorry.
But there is no kind of unified theme or soundtrack as such. That being said, though, a lot of those films were composed by Vladimir Kosma.
Oh, he's also a great guy.
Incredible. Yeah, incredible film. Composer on the par of like John Williams, and his soundtracks for the Asterix films are stunning, but they don't have a centralized theme, which again for this game doesn't really help it. But what they did come up with is very fitting and is very different from the other soundtracks, and they did release that CD. It's on Konami Soundtrack Volume 1.
I do want to say that, speaking of Konami music in general, a lot of game fans obviously are big fans of their music, but I feel like the wider public is mostly aware of their big console games, and I really suggest going back to like the early 90s, mid-90s, and just looking at all their arcade games that never got a home release, and checking out some of the music that they crafted for those games, because there was some amazing soundtracks in there. Metamorphic Force. Gaiopolis is awesome.
Yeah.
You know, Mystic Warrior sounds good. There's so many.
You got Asterix. Yeah. And, you know, as well as Izumi, I mean, Michiru Yamane worked on this.
Yep, she did. Yeah.
Egawa Mariko. I think Nakano Yunia even was on there. Hmm. So, like, you have, like, a dream team of composers working on this
another
game.
Another one, Roller Games. That's the soundtrack to listen to.
Yeah.
Konami's arcade version of Roller Games is insane sounding.
Just I didn't even know there was an arcade version
Seriously, go check it out. It's not as good as the NES game.
It's not as good of a game, but the soundtrack's great, and the technology behind it is incredible.
Yeah,
you know, the other day I saw on a stream that my friends do that we watched like a, I don't know if it was roller games. It was like WWF like mixed with skating. Is that what roller games was? Because
it was probably unusual.
Was
based on roller derby.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Was kind of
whatever that is.
You don't know the roller derby?
No,
the biggest sport of 1992 to 1994.
No, I genuinely don't know what it is. Does that bring us to a pause? I think place to stop, because I never anticipated that this would be honestly a two-parter. It could be a three-parter at this rate. There's so much to say about all these games, and we've got all. I mean, if that's the case, then that's the case. I mean, we've got to be exhaustive in our, you know, asterisks. We've got to get those vital statistics, etc., etc. nice. These Romans are crazy. I don't know how they say it. By Tutatis or something. I don't know what it means.
By Tutatis.
By Tutatis. What does that even mean? What is a Tutatis?
That's a Gaelic god.
Ah, okay. That makes sense.
The main god, basically.
So, Bai Tutatis is like the Asterix way of saying fucking hell, basically.
In a way.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
that's
in a
great way.
That's what they say when, you know, either that or the sky is falling.
Yeah, yeah. Now, we'll carry on with this in another future episode, I'm sure. We've got the Nintendo games to go. We've got all the other Mega Drive and PC games and eventually PlayStation games to go. So there's a lot to cover here, and I hope you've enjoyed this and the detail this has been in. I've been very, very pleasantly surprised myself, to be honest. I thought it would be good, but I didn't know it would be this good, you know? it's always nice when that happens. Now, let's go through in order. Ollie, where can people find you on the internet and enjoy your presence and work?
So if you go on Twitter, I'm PC98_Audi. You can follow me there. I will be on several videos on Digital Foundry. So go subscribe to them. Ring that notification bell. And send them a comment. Let them know you want more videos of DF Retro. And also go check out Limited Run Games, where I produce their internal developments, and I work very closely with a certain Mr. Parrish.
Have you put any interesting books out on the 29th of June, by any chance? A little book, you know?
Oh, yeah. There's a book coming out, which is called I Think Every Game is Good, or something like that.
All games are good, little book.
I live by that mantra myself. Yeah. I do collect
they are all good.
What people claim to be bad games, but, you know, I always feel like everyone else collects the best games. Why can't I collect the worst?
Mm-hmm. Hell yes. Mm-hmm. And John, where can our fine folks find you? Fine folk on the internet.
As usual, you can find me at DarkwinX on Twitter. I'm doing videos for Digital Foundry over at youtube.com/Digital Foundry. Check out DF Retro, of course. That's my baby. You could say, and Audie works with me on that and others, and it's awesome. And then also we do write articles on Eurogamer as well.
Can I just ask real quick, like, my cut this might not, I'm just kind of curious. Whenever you tweet anything about any game, have you ever done that and not been met with at least one person telling you you're wrong? And
no, like, never.
Ever. Oh, man. Because that's what I see, and this is not in no way a criticism, it's just an observation. These people are not that clever.
No.
They'll come at you and they'll think they've got you, but they've just said something that you've already addressed. It's wild. Like, I can't believe how stupid they can be.
It's shocking, and it is a daily thing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't envy that. You're very good at dispelling these people. I respect that.
What I found is this applies to everyone. Basically, once your Twitter account crosses a certain threshold, the garbage just comes in.
But it's just the awfulness.
There's great stuff too, though. But you open the door for that type of stuff as well.
Yeah. I mean, especially since you're talking about things like frame rates and like console war-esque kind of stuff. Thomas. Well, lovely, lovely, lovely Thomas. Where can we find you on the internet?
So if you would want to find me for whatever reason on the internet, you could check on Twitter at BimboFortuna, or you could check at maniac.de, where you can find the website of the magazine I'm writing for, where they usually publish my articles in German, of course, and also after they run their circle on the in the newsstands. But this is also where you could find me, yeah.
Amazing. And you can find me on the internet at Stupacabra. On Twitter, you can read my tweets, depend on in quality, very in quality, depending on what my mood is like.
Yeah, I noticed you were in a great mood at the Direct yesterday.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I was really disappointed by that Nintendo Direct, to be honest. And now I've slept on it, I've thought, you know what? It's a like Nintendo, so 2D Mario. It's probably going to be amazing. I should probably just stop doing this. Last time I did that, I was really upset that they did Kirby and the Forgotten Land, because I loved 2D Kirby. It was like the last bastion of 2D for me. And they made this 3D one, and I was like, this is rotten. I hate this. They've ruined Kirby. And then, of course, it comes out, and it's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. You know?
Yep, that's what happens.
I resolved maybe I should stop saying things. That seems to be the problem here when I communicate my thoughts. I should probably stop doing that. But no, yes, I've just had a book. By the time this goes out, the book will be out and hopefully sold out. It's called All Games Are Good. It's available through Limited Run Games. And it's about my unusual life in gaming and how I've come to be the way that I am, but it's done through the lens of like talking about lots and lots of individual games for lots of individual systems. It's a lot of fun. I think you'll like it. I think you'll get a lot of laughs out of it. And, you know, maybe you'll even learn something too. I'm going to stop plugging my book now.
So would you say it is an educational novel in a way? Or a novel of manners?
It is an education, yes.
But is it a warning?
It's a love story.
Is it a warning, or what is it?
It's a celebration, is what it is. It's a veneration of time forgotten. But that time could come again. We just have to kill people, but we're not prepared to do it. Anyway.
So I'll say that I got to read an early version of this, and I absolutely loved it.
Oh, wow,
so
thank you.
This this is a heartfelt recommendation to do pick up that book.
That's really kind. Thank you.
It's
thank
a wonderful
for,
book.
Thank you for reading it. Now, Retronauts listeners, if you enjoy Retronauts and you'd like to support Retronauts, which we'd be very grateful for, if you go to patreon.com/retronauts for just $5 a month, which you have to admit is really not that much money, you'll get not only a weekly episode a week early, but you'll also be getting 2 per month completely bonus episodes for no extra charge. Well, $5, but you know, that's it. So how much Retronauts can you handle, listeners? Because you're getting a bunch of it, that's all I'm saying. You'll also be getting Diamond Fight's tremendous columns this week in Retro, which are also recorded by them, so you can get it as a podcast as well. Even more additional content. You can come on the Discord and you can call me whatever you like, and I'm not allowed to challenge you in any way. So please do that, and thank you for listening. And I guess now all that there is to do is string up the bard and have a feast, a huge feast of wild boar in the dark, as is the ending of every Asterix book I've ever read, I believe.
Yep.
Except for one, where he's not strung up.
Oh, really?
But as you know, these Retronauts are crazy anyway, so.
Nice, very good. Thanks very much for listening, and cheerio. Bye.